So welcome to the final episode, find out who did it, of the Word of the Buddha. And so far, the Word of the Buddha has introduced basic teachings of the Buddha, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, using that as the main structure. And remember, the Buddha said that the only path to the purity of insight is the Eightfold Path. Eso wa maga nati anyo dasanasa visuddhiya. That's from the Dhammapada, the Magga Wagga. And another way of describing that path is the gradual path. And that gradual path is repeated in many, many, many suttas. It's in the Digha Nikaya, and it's also in the Majjhima Nikaya. And I'm going to, you can read it from your book, and I'll read it from the latest translation, which is obviously from the Majjhima Nikaya. And it's first in the Kandaraka Sutta, that's number 51 of the Majjhima Nikaya. And if you ever read the Majjhima Nikaya, you'll see a lot of dots go back to Sutta number 51, because it takes a long time to save printing space. It sort of refers back here. But remember, because it is repeated many, many times, it shows this was a standard, well-understood explanation of the path to enlightenment. So Eightfold Path is one way of putting it. This is another way of putting it. Sorry? I'm reading from number 51. Kandaraka Sutta. So here we go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Now, even the one we have here is slightly abbreviated. So I'm going to give the whole one here. But you can actually follow it from the book you have, and it's nice actually to see the difference in translations as we go. It's pretty similar, so you can usually understand what goes on. The first part is omitted from the gradual development. So that first part is here. A Tathagata appears in the world, that's the name of the Buddha, accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, know of the worlds. What does know of the worlds mean? Three worlds, yes. The Kamaloka, Rupaloka. Incomparable leader of persons to be tamed. And that admits that some people just will not be tamed. So, in other words, if you're fit to be tamed, the Buddha can do it. But some people are just beyond even the Buddha. Teacher of gods and humans. And so that means that when anyone says about your Buddha is nobody, he was not a prophet. You say, yes, that's true, because our Buddha was the teacher of your God. That's what it says, a teacher of gods and humans. So if they say, do you worship Jesus? No, we worship Jesus as Father's teacher.
Creates a lot of harmony.
If they're cheeky to you, you can be cheeky back. I remember sending that to Dr. Kesu Dhammananda, and he thought it was very funny. Yeah, the right time and right place. Enlightened, blessed. He declares his world with its gods and maras and its brahmas, his generation with its requisites and brahmas, its princes and people, which he himself has realized by direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma, beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end. With right meaning of phrasing, reveal a holy life is utterly perfect. So that's a prologue. Now, we come here to what's in your book. So a householder or a householder's child or one born in some other clan hears that Dhamma. So that's what we've got here. On hearing that Dhamma, they acquire faith in the Tathagata. Possessing that faith, they consider thus. Household life is crowded and dusty. That's why you always have to use vacuum cleaner at home. Use one here as well, but not in the cave. Life gone forth is wide open. It is not easy while living in home to lead the holy life, utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. That was just a simile, a metaphor they used those days. It doesn't mean so much to us these days, but you can understand the conch shell being polished on the outside, which is pure and perfect.
Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on a yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. On a later occasion, abandoning a small or large fortune, abandoning a small or large circle of relations, they shave off their hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home into homelessness. That's what you got there, first of all. Now, the morality chapter. Now, this is a long one here, but it's interesting. It's worth reading out, because it shows something which is even more fundamental than the monk's Vinaya or the precepts. This is actually shows that what a samana was supposed to be doing in those times, even before the Vinaya. So it's actually, it brings up a lot of interesting stuff here about what is expected of a monastic. Having thus gone forth and possessing the monk's training and way of life, they abandon the killing of living beings. You abstain from killing living beings with rod and weapon laid aside. Conscientious, merciful, you abide compassionate to all living beings. So that gives a little bit more insight into just what the first precept of non-killing is. It's not just not killing, it's actually being merciful, just being conscientious. And in other words, looking out for the animals, not just say, well, I'm not killing them, but no, they got in my way, that's their fault. No, you have to try and get out of the way. Abandoning the taking of what's not given, you abstain from taking what's not given. You take only what is given. You expect only what is given, especially as a monk. In other words, you don't go wheedling and trying to get something. You just accept, what you got. Expecting only what is given. By not stealing, you abide in purity. And abiding in celibacy, you observe celibacy, living apart, abstaining from the vulgar practice of sexual intercourse. Abandoning false speech, you abstain from false speech. In other words, you speak the truth, adhere to the truth, you're someone who's trustworthy and reliable. You are not a deceiver of the world. So it's not just telling the truth, it's a little bit more than that, because you can tell the truth. You can say, this morning I got up... I got up before 4 o'clock this morning. Or I got up, you say, today I got up before 4 o'clock. That's before 4 p.m. So sometimes you can actually use words, and you can cheat with words. So what was it in Singapore? I think it was Angie's mum used to, when he asked how old he was, he said, I'm much closer to 50 than 40. And people think, it must be about 46 or 47. He was actually about 65. Which is right. I mean, he's much closer to 50 than 40. So that's being a bit deceitful. It's not really telling a lie, because it's what he says is true, but it's being deceitful. So, you are trustworthy and reliable, not deceiver of the world. You abandon malicious speech. You abstain from malicious speech. You do not repeat elsewhere what you've heard here in order to divide those people from these. Nor do you repeat to these people what you've heard elsewhere in order to divide from those. Thus, you are one who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendships, who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, delights in concord, a speaker of words that promote concord. So that second part of right speech is very clear. It's a malice which tries to divide people, create disharmony. Abandoning harsh speech. You abstain from harsh speech. You speak such words as are gentle, pleasing to the ear, and lovable, as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by many, agreeable to many. So can you blast somebody? You stupid anagarika! You should know better than that. Is that kind speech? Is that gentle, pleasing to the ear, and lovable, and goes to the heart, and courteous? Of course it's not. No. So you shouldn't, if you're in a teaching position or you head out in Garrika, don't blast people. And you've heard me say before that the way to tell people off if you're in a position of authority, sandwich method. You know the sandwich method? I've told it many times before. So you say nice things first of all. Polly, and you're just such a wonderful, it's just so nice having you here for this rains retreat. I was just watching you sweeping today, and you were just so great, sort of sweeping and helping out. And you praise them, and then you hit them with it. But, Pauline. Yeah. And then afterwards you praise them. But, we really hope you come here again, and many times you can come and stay the rains in this monastery. That's called the sandwich method. And it works because you praise, praise, praise. And what happens then is actually people are opening their ears. Now they're waiting for the next one. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then it actually goes straight in. And afterwards, you know, you put the other piece of bread on the sandwich, praise them afterwards, they go away. Oh, yeah, I mean, no, I make a mistake. We all make mistakes, but the person respects me. And that's actually how we do the kind speech. But we can still tell people off. And abandoning gossip, you attain from gossip. Now, what does gossip mean? You speak at the right time. Speak what is fact. Speak on what is good. Speak on the Dharma and discipline. At the right time, you speak words that are worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. In other words, must be of purpose to it. Don't just speak for the sake of speaking. Now, this is some of the original members. This is supposed to be actually for people gone forth. So this is actually a basic underlying Vinaya. You abstain from injuring seeds and plants. So, you know, we can't, so that's why, you know, sometimes as one, as a monk or a novice, actually not for a novice, but for a monk, you can't go around sort of pruning the trees or cutting down the trees. You can't go around sort of growing crops for yourself. You practice eating one meal a day. Actually, that's a very bad, bad English there. Practice eating only meal a day.
Sorry, translated here is only at one time of the day.
That's right, it's only at one time a day, it's the right thing. Abstaining, because it explains it now. Abstaining from eating at night and outside the proper time. So that is where we get our rule. We can only eat, for eight precepts as well, from dawn until the solar noon. You abstain from dancing, singing, music, and theatrical shows. So you don't go around singing and dancing. You abstain from wearing garlands, smarting yourself up with scent, and embellishing yourself with unguents. In other words, no makeup. You abstain from high and large couches. So in other words, what that really means, as I've mentioned before, this is the eighth precept. It is luxurious. And seats which give you the idea of superiority, like a throne in big seats.
It doesn't talk about beds, though?
Not beds, but it's too over-luxurious beds. So for the monks, Vinaya, it's explained there that if it's a big sort of four-poster bed or a queen bed, no way. You say that. But if it's actually... say in your parents' house or you're staying in a hotel at night, you can use it in somebody else's lodging, but not in your own lodging. Yes?
Could you elaborate about the not harming plants thing? Because I've heard that it's, you know, it's like a cultural relic, but is there any, like, are you really...
It was because that plants were considered to be the beginning of an evolved consciousness. So it was for the fact that the harming of living beings went for the monks so far that you weren't supposed to even harm sort of grass. And I remember first hearing that when I used to go to Tibetan teachings as a layperson. They used to say, you know, even I will not get enlightened until the last blade of grass becomes enlightened. Understanding that even like blades of grass have some rudimentary form of consciousness which will eventually evolve into maybe human beings and thereby eventually become enlightened. And interesting, somebody sent me an email from Singapore a couple of days ago, and there was one lady who had a very strong NDE, near-death experience, in Malaysia. And she was saying that during that near-death experience, when she was out of her body, she actually recalled many past lives, almost like a whole swathe of them, and actually saw what she actually said in her own words, so the evolution of her consciousness. It's an interesting way of like having the law of evolution, not just, you know, of the body, the species in which we inhabit, but also the fact that our consciousness evolves over many, many lifetimes. And it seems to be indicated, although not said specifically, that our consciousness can evolve from simple plants. Thereby, so the monks were not supposed to get involved with those plants. It also means that the monks would be ecologically way ahead of their time by not being allowed to destroy things. It's so hard to cut down a tree or do something. So because sometimes, you know, you had to weed, you had to look after your vihara or your place, that's why the Buddha said the novices or the anagarikas could do that. But as a monk, you couldn't actually tell them. If you needed sort of a weed to be pulled out, you couldn't say, sort of, Nicholas, pull out this weed. And so what the Vinaya said, you should stand next to the weed with a spade or with some secateurs. And when somebody came up, like you, Greg, came up, you said, what are you doing, Ajahn Brahm? And I would say, you should know. And that's all you could do. That's as far as you could get. You go, you should know. So sometimes if we do things like that, you know where we're coming from. Yeah. Yeah. You're okay, yes. It's all right for you.
Put out something to cook for the monks.
That's okay. Please. Otherwise we'd have nothing to eat at all. That's okay. You can do these things. It's just like the monks had to have... It's not as if it's bad. It's not what they call... It's interesting. I was talking with the monks the other day. With the rules of discipline, the Vinaya, the morality, there's actually two classes there. What they're called lokavajja, which is like worldly faults. And that's not a worldly fault. No one will say that you are a scallywag, you're immoral, you're evil, by pulling out a weed or pulling out a carrot.
No, but then I think, you know that we pull out and then we destroy some,
We do, yeah. Yeah. So this is, but practicalities, there's nothing wrong with that. It's almost like a custom.
But I mean, if you're killing a consciousness or causing a consciousness pain, wouldn't it be better not to do that?
No, it's not causing it pain. Does the weed ever scream? You say, leave me alone, stop it. And you're helping get that carrot to get a much better rebirth.
I mean,
it's not immoral, okay.
Consciousness, and there's some reason that the monks aren't supposed to do it. So doesn't that imply that at some level they're causing this consciousness pain and it would be better not to do it?
No. Even actually having money. Is that really evil, having money?
Probably not.
No, okay. It's the same with that, but, you know, monks aren't allowed to do it. So it's just...
Why would the Buddha say specifically,
for the monks, okay, because some people said, look, monks, you know, you're supposed to be so harmless, that's your sort of image, even. So, you know, be super harmless. It had a very nice side effect, and I often mention this to people. The side effect was, the maybe unintended consequence, was the monks could not be farmers. They could not grow their own veggies. And that was actually a very great benefit, because if, you know, we didn't have this rule, we could, and we would, put our monasteries a long way further, you know, from the cities, you know, so we wouldn't get sort of bothered so much. We'd grow our own veggies and be totally self-sufficient, just like some sort of Christian monasteries. And that would have taken us so far away from, you know, the other lay supporters. But because we can't do that, we can't even cook for ourselves. That means that, you know, there is a dependence. We are totally dependent upon you. Without that dependence, you could see what happened. You know, if basically, you know, even just today, talking to people after the meal, you know, you get a bit fed up with that, and you just want to go back and meditate. So, and if I could, I'd just have my own veggie garden and just bye bye everybody. not even that, no. Yeah, does it? That's right. Yeah, that's. But that was very early on, before the Vinaya was understood. Afterwards, no.
From the idea that plants have consciousness,
What's
the basis of that? Is it Buddhist idea?
He does, yes. It's in the Sutta Nipata. It's also in one of the suttas in the Majjhima. And they don't actually translate it here. They say refer to the Sutta Nipata, the different types of beings. So it's only one place, and it's not central to his teachings. But I think the other Mahayana and especially Tibetan have taken that up. And it's from that saying that people say, well, you can evolve from a blade of grass. So when you're mowing the lawn at Jhana Grove, you are killing so many. No, you're not. See? Guys, you have a look at them. Yeah, I don't know, but if you look at in the Majjhima Nikaya, it's the one sutta which they don't translate, and they say, look in the. Do you know which one it is? No. I don't know which one it is. But it's in there, in the sutta part, it's also in this one too. Yes?
I heard it say that destroying the plants also coincides with that tree day.
Yeah,
and the tree dava can be the actual conscious state in the tree. And if you destroy the tree, you destroy the dava.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's one of the stories which they had for the monks there, when a monk was chopping down a tree, and he was chopping down that tree to make a hut for himself, and they said there was like a deva living in that tree, like a Buddha. And that Buddha was very upset that his home was cut down to build a home for the monk. So he went to complain to... No, I think he always tried to kill the monk. But I think the Buddha stopped him and said, look, you're making very bad karma, don't do that. And he said, look, in the Jeta Grove, that's where the Buddha was, there's a spare tree over there. And that's really top class real estate, you know, location, location, location. And for a Buddha to be in a tree in the Buddha's own monastery, that was really great. So he said, oh, thank you very much. And so he went to stay in this vacant piece of real estate, you know, in the best place in the whole of India, you know, where the Buddha was staying. So he was very happy. So it all worked out very well in the end. And then afterwards the Buddha said that so you shouldn't cut down trees because there may be some beings in there. And sometimes, I mean, well, this is one story when Ajahn Chakra was the abbot. There was this lady sort of came to see us. I think she was a Malaysian, married to an Australian. And her story was there was this big tree in the back of her yard. And husband wanted to cut it down with a chainsaw. And she had this dream the night before, you know, a being in there saying, don't cut me down. And so she told her husband, and being an Australian, that just encouraged him. So he got the chainsaw out and did it the next day. And when she was remonstrating, so, no, you're making bad karma. He had there two children, a boy and a girl, and he had the two children urinate on the stump. And the reason why she came to see Ajahn Chakra was about a couple of weeks later, he was diagnosed with cancer of somewhere or other, and the two kids had urinary infections. And it was just a coincidence, it was so spooky that she was really sort of really concerned. And so Ajahn Chakra said, well, look, you know, just go and ask forgiveness. She said, I can't do that because my husband will just, you know, really sort of go berserk. When he's at work, just you, no, don't tell him. Just go there with some flowers and incense and ask forgiveness of the tree deva. And she did that, and the urinary infections cleared up in the kids. But we didn't know what happened about the cancer. If it's a big tree, especially.
A big tree.
Yeah. Good example again with Bin and Yupa, who are here today. They've got this big tree in the back of their unit over in Nala Road in Nonamara, and they want to develop it. And now they felt uneasy about cutting down that tree, so they got me to go there, do some chanting, and to actually to make sure if there's any spirits in there, they can leave.
Because
all that council's going to be in big trouble. Sometimes you get a feeling for some trees. I remember reading in the newspaper in Malaysia they were building a highway somewhere or other, and there's a big Bodhi tree, and a huge one. And they couldn't actually get rid of it. And they tried bulldozing it, they tried blowing it up, and it just wouldn't go anywhere. It kept staying there. And in the end, they had to actually make a detour around it.
I think there's one tree in Singapore, the refilled.
Yeah.
They couldn't get rid of the tree.
Yeah.
And they tried, they put a lot of salt and stuff.
Yeah.
Because the tree
is
still there.
Still there? Yeah.
The tree
yeah.
is still there.
Yeah. There we go. Yeah. Yeah.
It's really dependent on culture, right? Because now we're used to, like, I have a nice bean bag, but you know, I'm not.
That's very true.
I'm not. What? On the floor, so
what would be luxurious, so 2,500 years ago, is common today. Mm-hmm. So as long as it's not luxurious, because again, this was especially for renunciants. And we are people who are supposed to renounce the world, and we live on charity. And you know that sort of resolution I made when I first became a monk, I would never live in an accommodation more luxurious than the poorest of my supporters. So, I mean, where do you live? And how hard it is to get sort of a house or get accommodation. And some people actually do live in homes west, or they live in an apartment. And some sort of monks, they live in houses, big houses or penthouses. And that's really inappropriate, especially that when they ask to be fed every day by you guys. Now, you'd love to live in a house like that with no mortgage and, you know, with all of mod cons. So there's something obviously very inappropriate for a monastic to live in a luxurious accommodation. And I think this is where it's coming from, whether it's a big house, you call it your abbot's hut, or you have its luxurious furnishings in there, then it's inappropriate.
So, when you travel, you go to the five-star hotel, do you sleep on the
floor? I do now. Because I remember the first time I went to one of these places, I slept on the floor. And when the housekeeper came in, she was so confused. She wondered what the heck I was doing, because I had a pillow on the floor. So sometimes I sleep on the bed. It is actually allowable. You can do that as long as it's in, they say, displayed in a layperson's house. In other words, it's a hotel, or if it's in a hospital or somewhere else.
You know how things that were luxurious then are now kind of commonplace.
Yeah.
Does that play into that what is moderate and middle way does vary from individual and to the time?
It does. It does indeed, yes.
So to work out what is middle, is it a matter of looking at the effect on the body and mind?
Body and mind, and also just what other people around that community really think, how they regard it too. So, stay from entering seeds and plants. 1 meal a day, dancing and singing, wearing garlands. Oh yeah. He abstained from accepting gold and silver. Now that is not the best translation, because when that's explained in the Vinaya, the gold, jata rupa, means money. Oh sorry, no, silver means money. The gold is gold, the silver means money. Accepting gold and money. And that was such a big rule in Buddhism, that in the Samyutta Nikaya, there was this story of these two, this group of lay people. And they were, I think they were gambling one evening. And they were just talking, just for fun, not serious. And they were talking to each other, and I think somebody won some money and said, I'm going to give this to one of the monks. And one of the other men said, oh, no, they don't accept money. I said, oh, yes, they do. No, they don't. So because they were gambling, they had a bet on whether monks accept money or not. So one of them went up to this monk, and they had to choose they chose a scallywag monk. And the scallywag monk actually accepted it. And so the guy, who was a very good Buddhist, he lost the bet. And he was really upset, so he went to see the Buddha, and he said, look, what's going on here? I didn't think you accepted money, but you know, this monk, scallywag monk, did accept it. And then the Buddha obviously sort of told that monk off. And he made this very, very strong simile. There's four reasons why the sun and moon don't shine. And that's actually clouds, eclipse, a dust storm, and there's one other reason. Forget now, anyway. But four reasons why the sun and moon don't shine. There's also four reasons why monks and nuns don't shine. There is, I think, sexual intercourse is one of those. I think stealing is another one. I think drinking alcohol is the third one, and the fourth one, accepting money. And then he said to this man, look, that's how serious it is. If any monk accepts money, they are not a disciple of mine. He's very, very, very strict on that. And that actually rule was actually singled out. Well, not singled out, but put on the same level, you know, as sexual intercourse and stealing. So it's not a light rule, it's a big rule. So we try and, you know, do our best with that, but sometimes people get upset when we try and ask for, you know, that rule to be promoted. And of course the only way to promote it is, you know, for lay people not to offer money to monks. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
And I found that explanation quite useful.
Good, yeah. That's a very good way. Your middle way in your practice of sila, or, you know, how you eat, how you sleep, how much you sleep. You have a comfortable body, not indulgent, so it's easy to let go of and allow it to disappear. Okay, that's gold and silver. You abstain from accepting raw grain and raw meat. In other words, you don't have sort of your supply of food, you know, in your storeroom or in your... This is for, you know, individual monks. The monastery can have it store, but I can't.
It doesn't have to do anything with eating it?
Well, it's actually just storing it so you can have it for later on, basically. So raw meat, in other words, accepting it so you can refrigerate it and just cook it later on for yourself.
So you can eat raw meat?
No, that's another rule. You can't eat raw meat, no.
But you can eat raw fish?
Can't eat raw fish either. This is actually, but how, what does it mean by raw? And so sometimes, no, we can't eat sushi if it's raw. If it's smoked or it's slightly cooked, then maybe. But if it's really raw, no, you can't. It's wrong. So that sometimes they say, what if you have like a steak? It doesn't have to be well cooked or raw. As long as it's got some cooking in it, that's, no, it's been seamed or something.
So if it's salted, you know.
Yeah, sorted. In fact, I've seen actually monks do this, that if they have any doubts about it, they just, you know, light a match and they just get Nanagarika to touch the match just to give it some sort of burning, a tiny bit of cooking, just as a... But no, it should have raw food.
Is it a health protection?
No, it wasn't a health protection. It was just... I'm not sure why, but it was not supposed to be appropriate for monks. There is one exception to that, and that if the monk is, has been possessed by a demon. And if the monk has been possessed by a demon, then just really going crazy, and he really needs like raw meat or blood, then he can give it to them. I don't know. That's just what it says. Yeah. Yeah.
So if some rules are a bit funny, is it a good way of understanding them? Oh, okay, maybe it's just to allow the people to...
It's mostly for simplicity. Mm-hmm. So just the way that you accumulate things. Mm-hmm. Now the rest of the things we're accumulating here are just like the worldly possessions, which would count for a person's wealth in those days. I think, and this is from monks accepting women, girls, men and women slaves, goats and sheep, fowls and pigs, rabbits and no, just kidding, and cats, elephants, cattle, horses and mares, fields and lands. So this is actually, in other words, you don't have what is considered to be like worldly possessions. You've got, remember we started off with gold and silver, gold and money, raw grain, meat, women and girls, men and women slaves, goats and sheep, fowls and pigs. This is actually what you'd be looking on as like your wealth in those days. So these days we'd actually be saying that anything else which is really wealthy possessions which a person has. So you keep it very simple. You don't have your own car, you don't have your own shares, you don't have your own property somewhere. So you keep it very, very, very simple.
true that a monk can own the land he's dwelling upon?
You can do that. If it's a land which is you have your hut on, it does seem that that's allowable. But you know, you can't have land which is going to be used for generating any wealth or money. You abstain from going on errands and running messages. So this is actually, you may have come across this. I may, for example, that after the retreat in November, I'm going to Colombo for the WFB conference. And so Sanat said, oh, you're going to Colombo, can you please take over something for, you know, one of my relations in Colombo? I can't do that. I can't run an errand for you. If it's for monastery or Buddhism, yeah. If you say, you know, I've got this for a temple in Colombo, yeah, I can take that for you. But not sort of like layperson to layperson business. So sometimes people have asked me that because I go travelling a lot. You know, even I've got a letter. It's important. Can you please sort of post it in KL for me? I can't even do that. And the idea is because, you know, some monks were doing those errands and messages for lay people, actually to carry their favour, to get sort of requisites from them. So that's not what a monk should be doing. You abstain from buying and selling. So, you know, you don't sort of say, look, I've got this really nice Word of the Buddha book here. Now, how much will you give me for it, Nicholas? Or well, I've got an extra calendar. That much. They don't do things like that. They don't go buying and selling. You don't. Okay, abstain from false weights, false metals, and measures. In other words, you know, sometimes that's cheating in when you are trying to find a livelihood. You abstain from accepting bribes, deceiving, defrauding, and trickery. You abstain from wounding, murder, binding, brigandage, plunder, and violence. And in the history of Buddhism, you know, sometimes the monks have got into that sort of way of trying to survive. And even was that, I think there's many examples of sometimes the monks getting very, very misbehaving, really losing their Vinaya. And obviously they do this. This part over here is trying to make what they call a livelihood for a monk. If you don't get enough food, you sort of take it yourself, or you buy and sell, you go on errands, you accept bribes, you use false weights to try and make a buck. Monks aren't supposed to make bucks. Instead, what comes up next is where we start getting the interesting stuff, the beautiful stuff. Instead, you become content with the robes to protect your body and with alms food to maintain your stomach. So not the other stuff. And wherever you go, you set out taking only these with you. Just as a bird, wherever it goes, flies with its wings as its only burden. That's what I get, you know, I often say, have you ever seen, I said the other day, ever seen a bird going international with a suitcase? You say, have you seen birds migrating with a backpack on? And actually, that, because I said that similarly, it was well known. One of the books in Germany was called The Bird with No Suitcases. That was the title of the book. And I really try hard to practice that. So, you know, when I go travelling, I do take my bowl and my bag, and sometimes if I know, for example, I'm just going to go to some conference, it's going to be a hotel, and you know, you can't use your bowl on those tables. So you just take your bag. Where's it gone? Oh, it's right here, yeah, this is it. And it's just so beautiful doing that. Number one, it's really light, no suitcases. And number two, when you get to the other end, and it's happened many times at Perth Airport, going through the customs, they say, sir, where's your baggage? And I say, this is it. And I say, I'm a monk. And they look at me and say, well done. And they let me go straight through. Because now everybody wants a monk to live simply. And sometimes people have got, they're very distressed to pick up a monk coming from overseas and they got all these bags with them. I say, what do you want that for? Because as a monk, you know, wherever I go, if I need something, there's so many people who want to sort of give you something. So, you know, if you need a towel, just ask. I mean, all these monasteries, our monastery's got heaps of towels. You need some soap. You don't need to put that in your bag. So what do you need in your bag anyway? There's a monk.
So this is why it's lovely when you can actually practice that. So any of you going anywhere, sort of please, you know, try and keep your possessions down to absolute minimum. Don't take so much stuff with you. And so you go, the monk becomes content with the robes to protect your body and arms food to maintain the stomach. And wherever you go, you set out taking only these with them. Possessing that aggregate of noble virtue, you experience within yourself a bliss that is blameless. And this is where the gradual path really starts to take off. Bliss. Now, you'll see as we go through this gradual path, it's all about bliss upon bliss upon bliss. The happiness is increasing. That's why it's a gradual path of increased happiness to the whole path of Paramasukha, highest bliss, which is enlightenment. And I also love this because when you start to keep your precepts and live simply, you have a much more fun in life. So not the Puritan idea where you've got to be good and be miserable. Buddhism is being ethical and having a wonderful time. And especially the simplicity. I have to tell that story. After 5 years as a monk, we had this practice in Thailand, being kicked out of your monastery. Bye-bye. Off you go. See you back in another year. And you had to carry all of your possessions with you. And you couldn't actually store anything in the monastery. You couldn't actually tell another monk or a story, can you keep this for me when I come back? Everything you owned you had to carry with you, walking. And so by the time you left the monastery, it was really down to the minimum. But after a day or two of walking, you realised it wasn't the minimum after all. You could still throw a few more things back. And after a week or two, you were so light. You had your bowl, your robes, the umbrella and the cloth so you could sleep anywhere. And that was one of the most joyful experiences of my monastic life. You had absolutely no responsibilities at all. No plans, no debts, no needs. You just had everything you owned in the whole world with you. And it was light. And you could go to any crossroad and you could make a choice right there, left, right, straight on, or turn around. And you had no place to go. And you know wherever you went to in the next morning, the nearest village, you go on arms around, get enough food to eat. And you were totally free. And that was actually incredibly blissful. Just that total freedom of just everything you needed in the world you had. And it was hardly anything at all. Any place you could go and sleep in a field somewhere at night time. And it was comfortable. You had no worry about a home, sleeping, food. You're just wandering, just with no attachments. Now this is what it means, that a bliss that is blameless. So I think you can get a feeling for that, what it's like. Free. Now that's only the start of the happiness. This is actually from keeping precepts and being good and being simple. Now let's see how we can go more into the happiness business. On seeing a form with the eye, you do not grasp as its signs and features. So what that actually means, a sign, it means it's like one part. So okay, so I can see your nose, Pauline. Now like for a man, some women have got really sexy noses. So sometimes what happens is if you're a man or a girl, if you see someone coming in, you go to that part of that person which excites you the most. If you're in a negative mood, you can get to that part which, you know, just really upsets you. Like someone who's, you know, your enemy, you don't like them, they really upset you. Some feature of what you see to justify your ill will. That's when we get just, you know, to see the signs, the features is the whole thing. It doesn't actually really come out here in that translation, but that's what it is. And seeing a form, you do not grasp these things, since you have left the eye faculty unguarded, evil unwholesome states of covetousness and grief, basically desire and ill will, might invade the mind. So you practice a way of restraint. You guard the eye faculty, you undertake the restraint of the eye faculty. So it's something you really like. It's like, you know, you go shopping. Some of the Anagarikas go shopping and you see something in there and you want it. As soon as that thought comes up you want, turn away. Restrain yourself. Otherwise you'll buy it. or you know, something happens which is really upsetting you, like you see that somebody has not sort of cleaned their plate very well, and if you don't practice restraint, you get upset. So you restrain your mind. That's what I have to do. I was telling somebody the other day that my, what's it, example, the person who inspires me the most in leadership, you know, what I try and emulate, you know, as an abbot, is a character in an old TV series called Hogan's Heroes called Schultz. And Schultz used to practice, that's what I told you, he used to practice sense restraint. He would guard the eye faculty. He put his hand up here and he'd say, I see nothing, I see nothing, I see nothing, when the prisoners were escaping. So that's eye restraint. So sometimes when I see you guys misbehaving, I see nothing, I see nothing. By restraining my eyes, I live a happy life. On hearing a sound with the ear, an odour with the nose, a flavour with the tongue, a tangible with the body, or cognizing the mind object with the mind. You don't grasp at its signs and features which will inflame you. So, you know, you have like a sensual thought come up. Don't grasp at its features, otherwise it will keep on going on. Or, you know, you start thinking about someone's really sort of, they shouldn't have done that. Don't grasp at that, otherwise it keeps going on and on and on and on. So you practice a way of restraint of all the six faculties. Now that's an important part of monastic life or even being on retreat. Which is why our retreat center in the main hall, remember Kantian thinks a note when we were designing this, I again thought to have no windows. In that. We've got windows high up, but the thing is you can't see through it, sense restraint. So, you know, if you're sort of having a boring meditation, you can't look through the window and just look at the trees and stuff. You know, you're really sort of stuck in that room, it's sense restraint. And the same in the monastery, I mean, there's nothing which is really inciting sort of the eyes, it's beautiful stuff. There's no beautiful carvings or paintings or stuff. We try and keep it as boring as hell. Not as hell, but as boring as middle way. So that, you know, you have to practice sense restraint. And it's why that monks shave their head, ladies shave their head, you wear sort of really dull white colours. There's no fashion sense here at all. It's not at all sexy or inciting. So it really sort of dulls the senses in the sense that you have to do sense restraint. The only thing which we do not restrain here is the food. It would be very easy for me to say, okay, let's have tasteless food. Healthy, tasteless food. So what we'll do tomorrow, we'll just have three big bowls. Now one for the staple, rice, potatoes, chips, whatever, spaghetti, whatever, all goes in one bowl. It'll be like a trough. And all the curries, you know, whether they're Sri Lankan, Thai, curries, whatever, they all go in the sort of the curry, and all the sweets all go together in the other one. Mash them all up together, just so you know it's you can have sense restraint with your food. It's a good idea. I remember Anuradhapura. They had the big troughs there because they had so many monks there. They had this big stone. There were troughs like pig troughs, and that's the only way they could do it. So people would actually come and they'd put their rice in one trough. And curries in another trough, and sweets in another trough, and you know, it would be all offered, and the monks could go and help themselves. You know, take you know, from this and that. So that's the only way they could do it. It's so many people. So the next retreat, Daniel, we'll just have three troughs. But the reason we don't do that, I can never understand that, was because this was something which I really saw as seeing a documentary about one of the most strict Zen monasteries, a Heiji monastery in Japan. Is really cold. People are so ascetic there, but the one thing they really did put effort into was making delicious food for the monks. And I thought, they're so out of character. Everything else, that's where they hit you on a stick if you start nodding when you're meditating. Everything else was so austere and ascetic except for the food. And then when the interviewer asked why that was, they said, look, if you don't have delicious food, you don't digest it and you get sick. And to me that just makes so much actually sense. Monks do have stomach problems. Even in the commentary, there's a story here and they said this is like a monk's disease because, you know, we don't have that much control over what we eat. So because of that, you know that if the food is not tasty, saliva doesn't come out, other stuff in the digestive tracts doesn't come out, so you don't have the juices there to actually digest it. It has to be delicious. So that's actually why even the Buddha said, yeah, you have to have delicious food. We don't go overboard, obviously, but that's something which is hard to do restraint. But with all that delicious food, sometimes you do have to have restraint. I was very restrained today. There was, being the first to choose, there was two ice creams there, and I did not take one of them. So that's my restraint today. I like ice cream. Anyway, so that's with your sense of restraint. Anything about that? But when you do practice sense restraint, there's a payoff. When you don't go looking at those beautiful girls, when you don't spend all your time reading the newspapers, when you don't sort of go around listening to music and stuff, you get this bliss which is unsullied. It's the next level of bliss. So it's not boring. After a while, the mind becomes so sensitive and still, it's actually happier. And those of you who have enjoyed yourself at this retreat, sometimes, why are you having fun here? Why do monks smile? They don't have sex, no TVs, all the stuff which people think is going to make you happy. It's actually restraint makes you happier. Precepts make you happier. And that's a powerful teaching. And that's one of the why. How come you guys are so happy when you don't see TV? It's because we don't watch TV. That's why we're happy. Now, let's get further. You become one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, when looking ahead and looking away, when flexing, extending your limbs, when wearing your robes and carrying your outer robe and bowl, when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, when defecating and urinating, when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking and keeping silent. Now, we come across that in the section of mindfulness, the four foundations of mindfulness earlier. And as I mentioned there, there is a translation error, which I pointed out to Bhikkhu Bodhi before, but he won't change it. Falling asleep and waking up, that is not what the Pali says. The Pali is very clear here. It's standing, sitting, asleep and awake. It's not that time between sleep and waking. Falling asleep means sleeping, waking. There's a totally different word. In here they have sute, that means being asleep. Falling asleep is nidan okamati. Totally different word. And waking up have jagariye, which means like wakefulness, means being awake. And the reason, this is an important point, if ever you do any translation, the reason why they've put these two words here, because they think, my goodness, how can you be in full awareness when you're asleep? So they thought, you can't be fully aware while you're asleep, therefore the translation must be wrong. So let's call it fully aware falling asleep, fully aware waking up. And that's confused a lot of people, because even the Buddha say, when you're waking up, you know, your awareness is not that strong. It takes time for your awareness, you know, to actually to establish. You know, you're a psychiatrist, you know that, Sanat. The brain has to turn on. It's a physiological thing. So you can't be fully aware when you first wake up. It takes a while for that awareness to grow.
Sometimes in the dream, you sort of carry on meditating
on. Oh, yeah, you can do that, yeah. But not always. But even if you carry on meditating, it's very rare that happens, but a lot of times you can sort of have all sorts of weird dreams where you're not fully aware. Now the point here is that, but again, most of the time when you're asleep, you're not aware at all. So the point is here, the full awareness, this is the sampajanya, it is, as the commentary makes it very clear, and the commentary is good here, this is actually knowing the purpose of this, knowing whether your actions are fulfilling that purpose, knowing whether it's really useful or not. So in other words, it does not have to be in the present moment. In other words, you sleep because you know the purpose of sleep. So with full awareness means tonight when you go to sleep, you know, what's the purpose of sleep? And why are you doing it? Do it well so that the way you sleep fulfills the purpose of resting, so you don't overindulge. So that actually is a wisdom, it's not a mindfulness aspect here. The full awareness, the sampajanya. Sampajanya literally means imparted with wisdom. So it's understanding why you're doing these things. You're understanding, obviously it includes some mindfulness, otherwise, you know, you don't know what you're doing. So when you're wearing your robes, you understand why you're wearing your robes. What's the purpose of this? Now why are you eating? Why are you drinking? Why are you defecating? Why are you urinating? Why are you going forward? So it's actually with wisdom. You're doing it for a purpose, mindful, aware, wise, what you're doing. Okay, so this is sampajanya, with wisdom, so what you do, you're not doing sort of mindlessly, not understanding what you're doing and purposelessly, it's all with purpose. So possessing this aggregate of noble virtue and this noble restraint of the faculties, and possessing this noble mindfulness and full awareness, so this is preliminary. Then you resort to a secluded resting place, a forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charna ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw. In other words, you go off quietly somewhere by yourself. Now, interesting here, this is what you do after you've had a lot of sense restraint and you've got very strong sila. Because sometimes people like to go on really on full retreats. It's like some of you during the men's retreat, you've gone on retreats, it hasn't worked out. You're not ready yet for the full retreat. Because the restraint, the simplicity, the precepts aren't strong enough yet. And I remember this when I did my 6 month retreat. It became very clear to me, if you haven't really got some really good sila and strong sense of restraint, long retreats like 6 months will send you crazy. I remember seeing this man in Thailand once who'd been in a cave for about 7 or 8 years. And you know, he was the real thing, really long hair and wild eyes. He was a crazy guy. And everyone thought he was, you know, this was enlightened because no one could make sense of what he said. And he really looked the part, you know, like a sort of a rishi. And now, to me, it was obviously, you could see right through him, he was absolutely mad. He'd been in that cave too long. So, you know, he didn't have enough sila or samadhi to actually maintain that sort of solitude for such a long time. So I understand that as a teacher. If people come along and they say, you know, can you find me a place in this monastery? I just want to be by myself for 6 months. No way. Because you go crazy, you go mad in too much solitude. So we do the preliminary trainings first of all. Keep your precepts. Have some restraint, first of all.
You said on your 6 month retreat, really brought home to you the need for very good sila.
Yeah.
Can you give some examples that illustrates just how fine the distinction you're making between the sila for a 6 month retreat and just the sila for 2 week retreat?
I think one of the things you notice is that, and each one of you will notice this, I'm just saying things which you can recognize. As you meditate and get into samadhi, your mind gets incredibly sensitive. And it sort of can amplify even the smallest of things. And with that degree of amplification, if there's even a small chink in your sila, it becomes a huge problem. And, you know, at that particular stage in your meditation, that if those chinks becomes a huge problem, that's going to sort of rock you for hours or days. So it has to be, you know, pretty good. Because you've got no one actually to talk to, no one actually to sort of say, oh, don't worry about it, it'll be okay. You're by yourself, but you can really sort of go off. And again, as a psychiatrist, and the people have in solitude become mad. That's right, yeah. So to be able to do that for 6 months and just to be totally antisocial is actually sort of quite interesting. I know that when I did that 6 months, people were really wondering what I was going to come out as, whether I'm going to be mad. I think some of them were disappointed that I, you know, wasn't sort of... anyway. So you can see this preparation before you really get into, you know, the deep retreats. So I'm returning from my Zaramshat. So now if ever we do have like long stay retreat places for lay people, I would check them out first of all. I won't let them sort of do like long retreats easily. You know, they have to do lots of retreats to make sure they really have got good seal and they know what they're doing, because otherwise I'll be negligent. And they, you know, they could get some psychotic cases. When returning from the arms round after the meal, you sit down, folding your leg crosswise, setting your body erect and establishing mindfulness before him. Whee! Bhikkhu Bodhi actually did listen to this one. Didn't actually quite listen, but not sort of in front of them, before him. That's actually as a priority, as I keep on saying, that sort of word. Abandoning covetousness for the world, your mind abide with a mind free from covetousness. You purify your mind from covetousness. Now remember what covetousness means here. Remember, it's the same word they use in the Satipatthana, you know, abandoning covetousness and grief for the world. But look what it means in this context. Abandoning ill will, meaning sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse and doubt. This is the first of the five precepts. First of the five hindrances, that's right, sorry. So covetousness for the world, loka abhija, is a synonym for the first hindrance. So when you see it in the Satipatthana, you see it in here and so many other places, it's the same thing. So covetousness for the world means the first hindrance. Sometimes usually called Kamachanda. So abandoning ill will and hatred, you abide with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. Now this actually also explains and elaborates on these five hindrances. Ill will is not just having no ill will, it's substituting that for compassion. Compassion for the welfare of all living beings and living beings.
Excuse me, Anna?
Yeah.
Is the Kamachanda right here, is that the same one that is the part of the dependent origination?
Dependent origination? No, there's no Kamachanda in dependent origination. There is dhanha, which is karma raga. No, it's karma dhanha, bhava dhanha, vibhava dhanha. So it's part of that, part of karma dhanha. Actually, it is the same as karma dhanha, the part of the dhanha of the dependent origination. Abandoning sloth and torpor, you abide free from sloth and torpor. This is great. Percipient of light, mindful and fully aware. So that's what sloth and torpor is, the opposite to being mindful and fully aware. Percipient of light. Now what on all can that mean? Of course, in a many-year view, when you get into some deep meditation, it's almost like a pre-nimitta stage, is where sometimes people see actually a sheet of light in front of them, like a screen of light. Things are starting to get literally bright. You're not seeing light with the eyes. This is just a metaphor which is common to all cultures, that when the mind gets bright, I always said it gets bright, you know, using a metaphor from the sense of sight. It brightens up. It gets more energy. You can see things more deeply. And very often people perceive that as a light. So this is just a sign the mind is energizing. So abandoning restlessness and remorse, you abide unagitated with a mind inwardly peaceful. So that's very clear what restlessness and remorse is. When you're inwardly peaceful, that's restlessness has gone. Abandoning doubt. So what does doubt mean? You abide having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states. You purify your mind from doubt. You know what's really skillful. And especially what's skillful in the way of meditation. Because it does come out, sometimes people say meditation, they come and say, they get to this stage and they don't know what to do with it. Is it supposed to happen? Is it not supposed to happen? They get some joy coming up. Should I follow this? Should I not follow this? They get a nimitta. Is this the right nimitta? The wrong nimitta? What's skillful? What's unskillful? When you don't know that, that's called doubt. Which means you can't go further. That's where you come and ask monks like me, you know, this happened, what should I do? After a while, you become so knowledgeable about these states that all doubt disappears. So you know exactly what's happening. You know what to do and what not to do. You purify your mind from doubt. Now, almost automatically, the result of having abandoned the five hindrances, having thus abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, we enter upon abiding in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. And as you know, that the real translation should be secluded from not the sensual pleasures, but the five senses. And Ajahn Brahmani has done a little research. I think he was actually writing this to Bhikkhu Bodhi, that when karma is used in the singular, it means sense pleasures. In the plural, it means the five senses. And so it's a different meaning there. And it's common throughout the suttas. I forget if I got it the right way around, but he was actually saying that it is true here, that it's very clear if you see the use of that word in many, many contexts, this doesn't mean secluded from sensory pleasures, it means secluded from the five senses. In other words, no hearing, no seeing, no smelling, no tasting, no touching. And that's a common description of the jhana. You can't sort of see, hear, or no five senses. And unwholesome states, that always is explained as referring back to the five hindrances. Applied and sustained thought, you know what I say about that. There's no such thing as thought. That this is movement of the mind on the object and holding the object. And now he does this brilliantly with the rapture and pleasure born of that seclusion. This is the cause of that bliss. It's because you're secluded from the five senses. The body and the five senses have gone. Oh, at last, I'm free. The same way when you have few possessions, you get the bliss of the freedom of being few possessions. When you haven't got all this worry about the five senses, so you can have at least a bit of restraint, then, oh, that gives you the bliss that is unsullied. You can notice that each one of these blisses is a simplification, a letting go, a renunciation. And the more you let go, first of all, the possessions, of the next of the restraint of the senses is the irritation and the busyness of the senses. And now you're letting go of all the senses in the body here. You get more and more bliss. These are all blisses made of letting go. So here, the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, of letting go of the body. Again, with the stilling of applied and sustained thought, this is a movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object, we enter upon abiding the second jhana, which has self-confidence. Now, I mentioned that in the jhanas last week. Self-confidence, what the heck does that mean within a jhana? It doesn't mean self-confidence. The word is ajatang sampasadakang, sampasadang. Ajatang means internal. Sampasadanang means confidence. So confident, so much trust, you don't need to hold on to that bliss anymore. The reason why you had this movement, which is here translated as applied and sustained thought, which even the commentary says is actually movement onto the object and holding the object, you don't need to do that anymore. It's a confidence which allows you to let go totally. Why can we let go? Because it's a lack of confidence, a lack of fear. There's some fear there. So this is a full letting go. And this is the confidence. And this is the singleness of mind without any applied sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of, now let's instead of call it concentration, stillness. Now it sort of all fits together. The rapture and pleasure born of stillness. Now nothing is moving. That what they say here, vitaka vichara, the movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object, that has now disappeared. So that stillness gives you the next level of ecstasy. So this is even more ecstasy. Because why? Because more things have vanished. And again, with the fading away as well of this pity, half of the bliss, you abide in equanimity and mindful and fully aware. This is not blanking out, because sometimes people say, oh, these jhanas, you're blanking out, you're just nothing there. No, it says mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure with the body, as I mentioned last week, this is not the physical body, the body of the whole experience. In other words, this is still pleasurable. The experience itself is pleasurable. You enter upon an abiding in the third jhana, on account of which no one's announced. You have a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. And again, with the abandoning of the pleasure and pain, and appearance and disappearance of joy and grief, when all that happiness and pleasure of all the six senses now has disappeared, you enter upon an abiding in the fourth jhana, which is neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. So this is getting to the fourth jhana, which is just the state of letting go. Now, with your concentrated mind, or not concentrated mind, still mind, is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, you direct it to knowledge of the recollection of past lives. Can you do that with an ajhana? Of course you can. You can't move in those jhanas. So this is actually saying that having emerged from a jhana, then that still mind, it's been purified, the jhanas have done the job, then you direct it to knowledge of the recollection of past lives. And I mentioned to you just how you do that in practice, coming out of a deep meditation, or it does actually work before you get into the jhanas. What's my earliest memory? And have fun. See what happens next. Yes.
I wanted to clarify something. So here we're saying that after jhanas, recollect the past lives, but after it's the liberation taken from the Tanyang Bhuti, and one of them, they can get liberated without the three.
Correct, yeah.
So why does Buddha say after jhana, recollect your past life? Why not just, like, you know, do the, why doesn't he just say, okay, just do the thing that you need to do to get out of samsara to end this?
That's a very good question. It does actually, in other places, that he says this is the first cracking of the egg by the chick who's being hatched, recollecting your past lives. And it just makes it easier to become enlightened simply because you have the big picture of dukkha. As many people have pointed out, if it's just people just believe they've only been born once and they will only be born once, this is life is all there is, then they will never really have the range to understand fully the problem of dukkha. Because one life, you can get by with it. Yeah, sometimes it's difficult, but it's not that bad. But when you say just life after life after life after life after life, then that really sort of makes dukkha come to a totally different level. It could be, yeah, they could do it that way, but this will give actually more data, more reason to understand dukkha.
Okay,
the problem will be not so much the dukkha of just sensory experience, but the dukkha of rebirth.
Okay, so Buddha wants us to, so this makes it easier, even though it's not necessary, it makes it easier to
correct, yes.
It's coming
out
the fourth jhana.
Yeah, fourth jhana, but look, it can happen after any jhana. It's just easier. The deeper the jhana, the more still you are, the more the mind is likely to do those things.
Yeah.
To direct it, just... Again, to direct it, it's just that little nudge. Because I've told you, I can't go too deep into my experiences, because that's my Paticca 8 rule. You know, before I told you just how you get early life memories and you can go further back, the same method works. What's my earliest memory? And that time when I first did that and got baby memories. And it's, you just have to nudge yourself. Just make one suggestion. What's my earliest memory? Just even subverbal. And all these memories start flooding back. If your mind is ready for it, it just happens. And if it's not ready, if it doesn't happen straight away, you're wasting your time. Don't try it twice.
So, but it's interesting that the Buddha, you know, from the three characteristics, that he's mentioning dukkha. So that's, so he's suggesting that that aspect of dukkha is making it easier to...
Yeah, very much so.
Dukkha. Because sometimes it's hard to mention anatta, it's easier, but here...
Remember, I think it's the Buddha, actually, his... This is just my conjecture. His main path of enlightenment was through dukkha. That's why the Four Noble Truths became his main first teaching. And, you know, the anatta would be a different way. And the anatta, maybe you would not need to have that recollection of the past lives, and maybe just through an anatta sanya or sunyata sanya, and maybe you can just bypass that.
But it seems so dukkha is easier because everyone wants happiness, right?
Yeah.
The whole path is towards happiness, so looking at it, that this is dukkha, just makes it easier.
Right? Makes it much very easy, yes.
Point you're making about anatta. There are some people who have practiced Buddhism for years, and they sort of seem to have decided that Stevenson's method, for example, is unsatisfactory. They find lots of reasons for basically just refusing to believe.
Oh.
In fact, they're very skeptical about past lives.
Yeah.
And this seems to put these people, right off.
Yeah.
But in fact, maybe that's inappropriate, because they should just say, forget it, just wait and
Indeed, but that's one important part of Buddhism. None of these ideas is forced on you. And so it's true, there's many parts of the Buddha's teaching when you first come across it. You say, no, I don't agree with that part. Other parts I do. Look, I mean, there's some parts which, you know, that even some of the monks here, like the Buddha sort of being born and being able to speak and taking seven steps and stuff like that, they think that's just a myth. But no, actually, I think that was true. And this is actually because when you really get into some tough meditation, deep meditation, just some of the things you thought were absolutely impossible, you actually can see how they can work. And that's the same with reincarnation, rebirth. At first, when you come into this, and it depends where you come from and what sort of background, you think, oh, it just is impossible. The rest makes so much sense. So after a while, it just creeps up on you. Especially when you get some nice meditation, you can see how it works.
So basically, the best thing to say is just put it to one side.
Yeah, put it one side. But you say the Buddha taught it, so you know, you've got to be obviously, this is what the Buddha said, but you don't have to believe it. Take the rest of it, first of all. But what I don't like is when they say, oh, the Buddha never taught it. So you know, you've got to be truthful and honest. So the Buddha did teach it. Okay, if you don't want to accept it, fine, but you know, please be honest. Yeah?
But I remember in the Sutta classes, in the Mahamara, when we're going through the Sutta, after Jhana, there was the Buddha said to point the mind to emptiness and permanence. So he didn't say the recollection of past lives. So what conditioning should we put after that happens? Do we?
We'll get Jhana first and then come on. Okay, condition, yeah. I do past lives.
Past lives.
Yeah. So don't do the sort of the... People like to fast track. And they usually waste a lot of time. Just go the slow track. And then you get much more interesting.
But how come the other sutras that have said those four things?
Because sometimes they focus on one thing in one place, focus on another thing in another place. The thing with this, with the gradual training, it's almost like a complete path. Where other aspects, they just have a snapshot of part of the path. The time when you get insight, like in the Bahya Sutta, you know, the scene is just a scene. There's times when you're actually focusing on just how to meditate. There's time when you're focusing on the precepts or letting go of some insight, wisdom practices. But this is actually the most complete description of a practical path, how it works, not just a theoretical eightfold path, but actually how it works one after the other. So this is actually why this was included in this book, because it is an important practical path of how enlightenment happens. So there you go. With concentrated mind, that's purified bright, you recollect your previous lives, and just the way that Pali has, 1 birth, 2 birth, 3 birth, 4, 5, 20 birth, 30, 40, 50, 100 birth, 1,000 births, 100,000 births, many eons of world contraction, eons of world expansion, eons of world contraction and expansion. So Buddhism has not one universe, but sequential universes, one after the other. Many hundreds of big bangs. And usually in English we just say we recollect many one birth or many births. But in Pali they always have this repetition. And there I was so named, of such a clan, of such an appearance, such was my nutriment. So as food, as humans we have, you know, food, rice and curry or fish and chips or whatever. Some other beings, they feed on joy. The worm and the pile of dung feeds on shit. So we have different nutriments. Such was my experience of pleasure and pain, such my lifetime, and passing away from there, I reappeared elsewhere, and there too I was so named, with such a clan, such an appearance, such was my nutriment, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my lifetime, and passing away from there, I reappeared here. So it gives you an understanding of what it means by recollecting your past lives. It's not just, oh, maybe I was that. You can have quite a full explanation of actually who you were, what you ate, what your lifespan was, and what happened to you. Thus, with the aspects and particulars, you recollect your manifold past lives. Next. With the stilled mind, thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, you direct it to knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings. With the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, you see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior, superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. You understand how these beings pass on according to their karma. Thus, actions is the word he translates, the translation of karma would be great. Karma is an English word now, everyone knows the law of karma now, so really should put under here the law of karma. I understand how being passed on according to their karma. Thus, these worthy beings, see how just polite this is, these worthy beings who were ill-conducted in body and speech and mind, with violence of noble ones, wrong in their views, giving effect to wrong view in their actions, they still call them worthy ones. Which is quite sweet in a sense that, you know, even in Buddhism, they're scallywags, but we call them worthy scallywags. On the dissolution of the body after death, I have reappeared in a state of deprivation, a bad destination in perdition, even in hell. But these worthy beings who were well conducted in body, speech, and mind, not with violence of noble ones, right in their views, giving effect to right view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death, have reappeared in a good destination, even in the heavenly world. Thus, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, you see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, who understands how beings pass on according to karma. So, this actually, this one, you can't really have without the form. You have to actually see previous lives, first of all, before you can really understand the workings of karma. To that degree, anyway. It's important to understand that, you understand how these things work. It's not quite the Buddha mind, but getting up there. Because only the Buddha understands it totally, he said. No one else can understand it fully. When the concentrated or still mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, you direct it to knowledge of the destruction of the asavas, here called the taints, the outflowings of the mind. This is why your mind is sitting still there and it goes out into the world to play around and mess around. You direct knowledge of the destruction of the taste. You understand it actually is. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of the suffering. You understand it actually is. These are the outflowings. This is the origin of the outflowings, craving. This is the cessation of the outflowings. You let go. So if you stop controlling, stop craving, the mind doesn't go out anymore. And this is the path leading to the way leading to the cessation of the asavas. So that's the third thing you do. And in that simile of the chicks hatching out of the eggs, the first crack in the eggs is seeing rebirth or reincarnation. Second is when you see the working of karma. And this is the third and final cracking out of the egg. So you've hatched. You're an arahat. When they know thus and see thus, your mind is liberated from the outflowing caused by sensual desire, from the outflowing caused from just wanting to be, from being, bhava, bhavasava, and from the outflowing caused by ignorance or stupidity or delusion. And when it is liberated, there comes the knowledge it is liberated. It always comes, you can't be enlightened and not know it. Zen people used to say that. You know, might be enlightened because you can be enlightened and not know it. That's actually quite reassuring for many years until you found out how stupid that was. So if you're liberated, you know you're liberated. If you're not liberated, sometimes you can think you're liberated. But you can't be liberated and not know it. He understands, well, they understand, birth is destroyed. Now that's the first definition of enlightenment. No more birth. The whole of life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. No more rebirth. This, I can actually see, they actually set on to something else on there. So that is the end of the Great Eightfold Path. They've got some poems on the end over here, but we'll come on to that in a moment. Any questions on the Eightfold, on the Great Eightfold Path yet? Yeah.
So that's how we understand it, right?
Yeah, I think.
There's some
arahants about that. They do, yeah, but remember that just this happens naturally, automatically.
Right, so we just
make it, just keep it natural, yeah. If it happens, beautiful.
I think it's like this with developing or developments in our Buddhist view. Thoughts coming there, but there is no discussion towards them, or these things don't arise at all.
Basically,
there is no trace of desire and anger, not all that. But as some other monks say, that they just appear, but you don't react to them, they just like near sound or something coming in.
That is, well, there'll always be sub-desire. No, not well, just because of common sense. Because when I was a young monk, I thought, if an arahat has no desire, then what happens if they want to go to the toilet? Why would they even go to the toilet? Why would they just, you know, pee where they are? It takes actually desire to move. So there is actually another wise desire. So there's no sort of like craving there, and no understanding of a sense of self, no. An understanding that all these things are just playing around, doing what you need to do. But I cannot see an enlightened person ever sort of exhibiting anger or exhibiting sort of craving.
You don't react to the anger, but you get thought of bringing up some anger, but you don't react.
I think there may be some what they call patiga. The example which you give there. It's actually a very nice example that the Buddha was sitting on a bench, I think it was in Gaya, and this Yaka Suchi Loma came to sit next to him to test him out. And Suchi Loma literally means needle hair. So he was a prototype punk. So his spiky hair, but all over his body. And so this was this monster with spikes, you know, like with needles, sat next to the Buddha and started a conversation. And then he sort of leant over to the Buddha to sort of prick him. And the Buddha leaned away. And Suchi Loma said, "You're not enlightened. You've sown some negativity towards this sensory experience, some ill will towards being pricked." And they would have said, "Oh, look, this is just common sense, because it's just like you step away from a snake, or you'd sort of let go of a fire. You know, same with you. You know, that because I think your touch is unwholesome, therefore I lean away." So there would be a sense of ill will, a sense of negativity towards that. And that's even coming from a Buddha. And then when actually Suchi Loma realized that this was really a Buddha, then I think he went down and he asked forgiveness. And as soon as he asked forgiveness, all his needle hair fell away, and his karma from the past, which made him get reborn in such a state, was vanished. Just with that beautiful act of forgiveness. I like that ending to the story. So you can see that sometimes there will be a negativity there. Yeah?
Knowledge of outgoing, so is that what it says? So directing
Yeah, the knowledge of the suffering and the outgrowths, yeah. So they use it as a synonym, not synonym, but they always actually have it together, Four Noble Truths, either dukkha or asavas. I call it outflowings. It could mean inflowings, but I prefer outflowings because that makes more sense with, you know, the way my mind works. That's why, yeah, why they come from. You know, there is, the mind goes out into the world. And that's suffering. And why did it go out? Because we want something. Craving. When we let things go, we renounce. It stays at home. And the way to do that, Eightfold Path. Yeah. Now we have some beautiful poems. Some, and this is back on the word of the Buddha. Forever am I liberated. This is the last time that I'm born. No new existence wait for me. So I like that one. Forever means you can't become enlightened and sort of regress again. Because actually in Buddhist, we might call Buddhist theology in the history, that became one of the big questions. Can you become enlightened and then regress afterwards? I think what happened, I mean, a few monks have probably sort of said they were enlightened. And you know what monks are like. Sometimes they found out they weren't, after all. And so what was going on there? You know, were you enlightened before and then you regressed? No, they couldn't have been enlightened to begin with. So once you're enlightened, forever you're enlightened. This is indeed the highest, the holiest wisdom, to know that all suffering has passed away. It's the greatest insight, the insight to know you're liberated. This is the holiest peace, the highest, holiest peace, appeasement of greed, hate and delusion. In other words, quieting down. Now the silent thinker. I don't know why people kept on calling these thinkers. How can you be a silent thinker? You're either silent or you're thinking. This is called the Santa Muni. Muni means the sage, the wise guy, the wise girl. So this is the silent wise one. Yes. Okay, because the stream winner is the one who sees Anatta first time, but just through the wisdom has been purified, but not the thought, not the perceptions.
The experience
of seeing the Dharma, beautiful simile, the shipwrecked sailor seeing the shore for the first time, and now you've got to swim and get to the shore.
This
means there's no more birth. You've done what needs to be done. Not only have you seen the shore, but you swam to it, and now you're sitting on it. It's usually not the case. You usually go through stream winning and all the stages, but maybe somebody does it. Fast guys, with kids. Well, I think a lot of those were stream winners before, and once returners, non returners. So, anyway, the silent thinker, or not the silent thinker, the wise sage, the silent sage, the Santa Muni. Santo means peaceful. That's where you get this idea, saint from. Santa Claus should be the peaceful Claus guy, but have you ever seen a Santa Claus? And it's the last person who's peaceful. I am is a vain thought. Vain means stupid. So think you are. This am I is a stupid thought. I shall be is a stupid thought. I shall not be is a stupid thought. Stupid thoughts are a sickness, an ulcer, a thorn. But after coming all stupid thoughts, one is called a silent sage. And the sage, the silent one, does no more arise, no more pass away, no more tremble, no more desire, for there's nothing in them whereby they should arise again. In other words, the seed has gone. And they arise no more, so how should they grow old again? As they grow old no more, how shall they die again? As they die no more, why should they tremble? And as they tremble no more, how should they have any desire? So it's one of those things which people like to waste a lot of time thinking about, because people always like sort of, you know, weird and sort of obtuse sayings. But it's pretty close here. It's just the reason why you tremble is because of the fear of death, they were saying here. Because it won't die anymore. No need to tremble, no need to desire. Hence, the purpose of the holy life does not consist in acquiring arms, honour or fame. No matter how rich you are, or how well known and famous you are, nor in gaining morality, stillness or the eye of knowledge. It's not even for jhanas. About that unshakable deliverance of heart, enlightenment. That indeed is the object of the whole life. That's its essence, that's its goal. So all this other stuff, the morality, the sort of the getting a monastery which is well supported, that's not the goal, that's not why we're here, to have the best monastery and a well supported monastery. You're not here to get these little rewards like a chalkun or something. That's why I put it around the corner over there. I only get it out once or twice a year. That's not the purpose. The purpose of this is not even just to be the most virtuous monk in the whole world, or the most adept to jhanas, or the most insightful. It's just for one reason, not to get reborn again. And those who in the past were holy enlightened ones, it's one place to say this was not the first Buddha. Those who in the past were holy and enlightened ones, those blessed ones, also have pointed out to their disciples the self-same goal, as has been pointed out by me to my disciples. And those who in the future will be holy enlightened ones, those blessed ones, those Buddhas, also will point out to their disciples the self-same goal has been pointed out by me to my disciples. So this is an ancient path. It's been going on for a long time, many eons. Much older than the indigenous culture of Western Australia. We've been around longer than any other religion. Because we can put up our Buddhas back to the previous universe and the universes before then. That's cool.
Why does it say self-same?
Oh, that's just self-same is just the English word. It means exactly the same. However, this is nice at the very end, because this is one of the Buddha's last words. However, disciples, it may be that after my passing away, you may think, gone is the Dhamma of our master. We have no master anymore. But you should not think, for the Dhamma and the Vinaya which I have taught you will after my death be your master. And that was one of the most powerful sayings. Does that stop Buddhism, you know, being a hierarchy, even though it isn't many places, but it hasn't got any justification? No pope, no sangharajas, no mahanayakas, no sort of abbots, no sort of big bosses. You know, your teacher is not me. Your teacher will always be the Dhamma and the Vinaya. I have no right to supplant that. I can be just the help, but your master is the Dhamma and the Vinaya. Let the Dhamma be your isle. The Dhamma be your refuge. Look for no other refuge. Not in a person, not in things, but just Dhamma. Therefore, disciples, the doctrines which I taught you after having penetrated them myself, penetrate first, then he taught them, you should well preserve, well guard, so this holy life may take its course and continue for ages for the weal and welfare. The weal means the happiness, the well-being and welfare of the many, as a consolation for the world, for the happiness, here goes the weal again, and welfare of all heavenly beings and men and women and gays and lesbians and transsexuals. And cats and rabbits as well. Yes?
Okay, so this gradual training, it does, it's very monastic. sense, so yeah. Everybody
who
listens to
it,
they know the game.
Yeah, yeah. Now, because the reason was because it was taught to monastics in that way.
Okay.
But it still applies to everybody to have simplicity, few possessions, sense restraint, deep meditation. See what happens.
So
you
still teach it that way to make people?
Yeah, gradual training. That's a nice another way of looking at the Eightfold Path in practice. And one thing I really like about that, because of one of the first times in the suttas, it was taught, this is a middle length sayings, the second actually group. The first group is usually the Digha Nikaya, and it comes in the second sutta, the Samanyapada Sutta. And it came as a result of King Ajatasattu asking the Buddha, what are you doing this for? You know, you're of royalty. You know, why are you a monk? And basically he said, for pleasure. And this was the fruits of the holy life. And he went through all this, you see. See, you get more and more happiness the further you go along. And that's the first time he said, basically, for, you know, we get much more pleasure than you do, King. And that sort of really sort of impressed the king, who was really into his sensory pleasures, to realize you get more pleasure when you have sense restraint and sila and get the jhanas and get enlightened. And that's a great sort of answer when people ask you, what did you do spending 3 months in the monastery? I did it for pleasure. And they go, well, how come? Do you have sex? Do you have movies? They say, no, much more pleasure than that. And that gets people interested. Yeah?
Yoga dosa is cleared up.
Ah.
You have no more desire and attachment. How come that metta is, those things take, how many that selective you goes to and not the rest?
Okay. No, usually with the realization of non-self first time, that's usually the stream winning. Because what actually happens is your view gets purified. But then the nature of the mind, you know, as a psychiatrist you'd understand this, it sometimes is a creature of habit. It's conditioning after that experience. It's not totally from that experience. Sometimes it's conditioning from the past. So the old habits of greed, old habits of ill will kick in. Similarly, which I used before, is like a person who's like smoking. And they really realize just how smoking is bad for you. And they see it really big time. Maybe they see their father die of lung cancer. They know smoking is bad, but they can't give it up yet. They know it's bad. They know it's bad for them. But after a while, they keep thinking about that, and after a while, they have to give up smoking. It's only a matter of time. So when you see this anatta, all this craving business, it's stupid. There's no point to it. But you can't give it up yet. It takes a while. So that's, you know, once you see non-self, it is the defilements are mortally wounded, but it takes a while for that momentum you built up in the past to dissipate.
Seven.
Yes,
similarly,
yeah.
One metta and all those things should be eliminated. There's no self to
metta. Oh no, the metta is that's the only thing left. That when sort of the other defilements of the non-self and sensory desire and ill will have gone away. That's the only reason why an arahat, once you become enlightened, continues on. So they can actually be either a field of merit for other people or do some service for the world. So that was actually what's motivating the Buddha. Now why did he teach? All his enlightened, all his defilements were totally overcome. No more problem for him, he done what needs to be done. It was only out of metta. And a compassion for the world. And one of the characters in the time of the Buddha is Dabba Malaputta, usually called Dabba the Malian. And the Malas were supposed to be really rough guys and really coarse people. But after he became enlightened as a 7-year-old novice, so they say, what do I do now? And he wasn't a good teacher, he didn't have that ability to teach the Dhamma. So what he volunteered to do was to be like the monk around Rajagaha, the vulture speak and bamboo grove, all those other monasteries, who would actually allocate the lodgings for the monks. So, you know, when any monk or visitor came, he would know which lodgings were free and he would make sure they were well looked after and he would meet them and take them there.
Now, you've been on pilgrimage to, you know, those around Radhika. It's a huge mountain sort of encircling the old city. So, you know, sometimes it would take a long time to get there. But that was his job, because he'd serve the Sangha. And because he was enlightened with psychic powers, you know, he could actually light his finger to make a torch. So at night time, he could actually take them which way they wanted. And he was so good at this that monks would deliberately come late. So the Dhamma Dhammala could actually take them to this hut and that hut, that asked for the father hut, because they'd like to see psychic powers. And that was Dhamma Dhammala, Dhamma Dhammala Putta. So he would actually do that just out of compassion to serve the community, because he had nothing else to do. So actually metta was what motivated him, until he was also one of those monks. When he got to the old age, he just rose up into the air and self-immolated, entered the fire element, and that's how he entered Parinibbana.
How do you make the practice of metta and the other thing from the cause ability to create?
If there's a sense of self behind them, yeah. But if they're pure, especially coming from an arahant, obviously no. It's, by craving, I mean the craving which leads to rebirth.
Yes, that's what
yeah,
I mean.
Yeah.
How do they look at craving?
Well, sometimes when you have metta towards someone, you can get personally involved. This is what Ajahn Chah, when the first monks, and Ajahn Sumedho's monks, went to England, his words of advice were, be careful of practicing too much metta. If you practice too much metta, you end up having babies. you know, the young monks, you have metta towards this poor lady who's, you know, lost her husband and stuff like that. And sometimes the metta can very easily turn into attachment and romance and lust, and then you get married. It's a really great saying. Too much metta, you end up having babies. It's really wise. The same with that girl. And sometimes you get married out of metta. You sympathize with that man who tries to, it's so hard to just let you marry him and just think, oh, after a while, I just be kind to him. You end up having babies. So be careful of metta. Okay, so there we go. That's the word of the Buddha with some suttas. And great, we do this because at least anybody who spends the rains here, you learn some basic teachings of the Buddha, the Dhamma. Nothing sort of weird. Just all four noble truths, eightfold path, the meditation, enlightenment, just the essence. So at least you know what the Buddha taught. Whether you accept it or not, that's up to you. How much you understand is up to you. But at least you know that's what the Buddha taught. That's a brilliant thing, because some of the stuff which you see in the world, what people say the Buddha taught, it's really weird stuff. So at least you have a framework now.